Bob, alcoholic. I want to thank Craig for asking me to come down.
Yeah, come down.
And I'm glad I got water. And I'm disappointed they don't have my favorite pamphlet in the literature. Maybe if you had some meeting, you remember, look at the pamphlet literature. But my favorite one is It Sure Beats a Jail Cell. My personal favorite. It's always a real privilege to do what's asked of me in AA. I want to say happy anniversary to the anniversary folks, and I know there are a lot of people here with a lot of sobriety. A couple of weeks ago, I celebrated my 25th anniversary. And one thing about being, you know, sober a while is I really realize I really have less to say. So I'm going to do a lot of filler tonight. Because it's... I think maybe when I was 15, I had a lot of answers for everybody, and probably when I was 20. But lately, it's just kind of been, what meeting am I going to meet you at? And I don't look like it, but I am a lower companion. And, clean up pretty good. My, you know, when I was driving here from Santa Monica, I was just reflecting a lot on a lot of the people that were there for me. And I always talk when I have an opportunity to share about my sponsor. And I lost my sponsor, a man named Eddie Cochran, who... passed on with 47 years sober, and Eddie was my main guy. And I like to say his name and other people that were there for me when I was new, because then they're with me. They're ever with me. And when I first came in the rooms, there were people like this guy Norm Alpe and Eddie Regan, and just a lot of really solid, good AA folks. So again, I'm a lower companion. When I was 9 years old, my mother tried to kill me with a butcher knife, which probably, I again don't know if that has anything at all to do with my alcoholism. What I'm completely convinced of, it had a lot to do with me feeling unlovable. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned a word called shame. But that's what I got at 9 years old, was the feeling of shame and the feeling that I'm unlovable. My sponsor, Eddie, said it, that I have this cosmic turd that follows me around in the universe. I had a different way of breaking it down. For those of you, I can see I'm going to be all over the place tonight, but for those of you who didn't know Eddie Cochran, Eddie was a happy alcoholic. His nickname was the Grasshopper. And I'm the angry, depressed type, so just a perfect match. So at 9 years old, what I took out in the world with me was the feeling that I'm really unlovable and not worth anything. And I had my first drink when I was 12, and I got drunk the first time I drank. I drank alcoholically from the gate. I don't think I've ever had a social drink. I got drunk, got sick, passed out, got up in the morning, and went to my dad's liquor cabinet. And that's the way it started, and that's pretty much the way it stayed. Alcoholic, when I was 12 years old, took all that pain and awkwardness away. It didn't matter about Mom and the butcher knife. It didn't matter about how I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere, and just made the world, it was my medicine. You who are alcoholics sitting here know what I'm talking about. It was like truly my medicine. And when you're 12, people expect things of you, you know, like going to school and things that really kind of interfered with my drinking. And so when I was about 12 and a half, I left home. And I moved myself, we used to call it on the nickel, how things change, but I moved myself to Skid Row in downtown L.A. And I loved Skid Row. I drank for years down there. I drank in the bars that have sawdust on the floor, and they never changed the sawdust. And the winos and the winettes used to look after me because I was the only kid there. And, you know, particularly the winettes, they made sure I always had something to eat. And, my drink of choice was Four Roses whiskey from the bottle. And I loved whiskey. And when I was about 15, I started mixing my whiskey with a little heroin, and that combination served me really well for a long time. You know, I have guys that I sponsor that are alcoholics and also do like speed or cocaine, which I never understand why anybody wants to be more present. I mean, see, the mark I was shooting for was numb. I'm shooting for coma. I'm shooting just for that place before you're clinically dead. Then I'm happy. Now, what's kind of wonderful is the steps work on all of it, you know. So that combination served me real well. Alcohol always being my first and primary choice, and then I would mix it with other stuff. And one of the reasons I liked Skid Row was that you have to be a lower companion to get the lower companion handbook, but it has a chapter in the lower companion handbook that says you don't ask each other anything awkward or embarrassing, like, what are you doing here, you know, where's your parents, nobody ever asked me, why aren't you in school, you know, they just kind of let me alone to drink the way I wanted to drink. So Skid Row was a very safe, comfortable place for me. When I was 17, I had a little trouble with the law enforcement and went through a long trial, and they convicted me as an adult. I got convicted of 46 counts of armed robbery with a sawed-off shotgun, and every count was a Vons Market. Now, the reason for that is, see, I went into the first Vons Market with my shotgun, and it went so smoothly, I just went back to a second Vons, third Vons. I managed to get about three counties worth of Vons Markets, and I still get a little deja vu, you know, if I remember on my way home from here that I got to have milk for my cereal in the morning, and I stop at Vons, I always get a little moved. But they, sent me up to a place on the bay in San Francisco. And, I see some of you know the place. And, for me, San Quentin was like Skid Row. It was safe. Did that penitentiary pruno, that, you know, homemade booze that you just drink about an inch of it out of a mason jar, see some heads of recognition, and you got to use the walls to walk. I mean, powerful alcohol. Did whatever else was there, maybe something to do with my mother, I don't know, but I had a little anger and rage thing going on, and it was a perfect environment that kind of reinforced that behavior. joined all the right affiliations. I'm kind of dressed up, but you know, I'm covered from head to toe, a full body, and have a very glaring, well-known affiliation across my chest. And really, because I was really a frightened little boy and didn't know it, so I had to get all that protection on me to keep you from hurting me, and had a lot of violence. And the violence was really about untreated alcoholism. And the great thing about the penitentiary, like Skid Row, nobody ever asked me any of those awkward things. You know, like, I did 6.5 years in San Quentin, and not once did anybody ever come up to me and say, you know, Bob, I've been meaning to ask you what your career goals are. You know, I was thinking, Bob, I was going to talk to you about what university you're going to attend. You know, like, I'm most comfortable with other lower companions. And while I was there, I had a lower companion as a cellmate. And same kind of rage and anger and untreated alcoholism as myself. And always want to be careful around, you know, anonymity. But so if he ever speaks, or you could ask Danny T what really happened, and he'll probably tell you. But Danny, I think, just turned 31 or 32 years sober. And Danny was my cellmate. And something happened where Danny got sent to Folsom. And you could ask Danny. But I figured I'll never see Danny again. He gets shipped off to Folsom Prison, and that's that. So it's a couple years later, I parole. I'm didn't bother to check in with a parole officer, and was back to drinking and doing what I always had done, the only thing I ever knew. I kind of felt like this is the hand that got dealt to me, and that's the way it is. Complete hopelessness. And just had to get my medicine. So I was in a market, not a Vons market. There are no more Vons market. And I know this is a pretty upscale group here, so I don't really know if there are any armed robbers here, but if there is, you'll identify with this. You know, you have to wait for that intuitive feeling that it's okay to go forward. So I'm in the market, and I got my shopping cart, and I'm getting pretend items in the cart, and I go up to, like, you know, where they keep the milk and that, really so I could look in there and make sure there are not people in there waiting for somebody like me to come in. And I've kind of got my little shopping cart. I've got a altered shotgun with men's suspenders hanging loosely over one shoulder so both my hands could be free, and my jacket covers it, and with a suspender, so you don't even need to do anything. You just pull it out. And, you know, a double barrel 12-gauge sawed off is an intimidating weapon to most people. So I'm waiting for that intuitive moment to go forward with my little armed robbery, and this guy, Danny T, comes up the aisle, the guy that was my cellmate, and he recognizes me, and Danny basically 12-stepped me in the market. See, he had found you folks some years before. And Eddie, he just took me home. Danny just took me home and put me on his couch. And started taking me to you guys. And 25 years ago, there weren't the treatment centers there are now, so I got the old-fashioned AA way, you know, where I got babysat this part of the day, babysat another part of the day. I was going to meetings for a few weeks, and I was really, truly happy for all of you. I was genuinely really happy for all of you, but I knew that it could never work for me. I mean, the most I could come up with was that it could never work for me. I was too damaged. I was just way too damaged. But I was genuinely happy for you folks. And back then, like, they had a lot of sober activities, sober dances. Every Sunday was somebody's birthday, anniversary, a barbecue, hangout. And I get attracted a little bit to Danny because of the laughter. Because I saw I wasn't laughing, but I saw Danny laughing. And Danny, again, being an alcoholic of my variety, I didn't remember him laughing in San Quentin. And so that attracted me a little bit. And I was kind of making my exit plan to leave you. And I was at a meeting with Danny, and he introduced me to this guy named Eddie, who became my sponsor. And for 25 years and a couple weeks now, I haven't had to leave you. One of the things that I think was really significant to me was just a couple months sober, and kind of Alcoholics Anonymous had been happening for me from the neck up, but not below the neck. And Eddie called me up, you know, at the sober house that Danny put me in, called Chandler Lodge over in North Hollywood, a very basic, nothing fancy, just good AA. And Eddie called me up in the afternoon. He said, "Bob, I can't pick you up tonight to take you to the meeting. My dad had a heart attack. He's in the VA hospital. I'm going to go be with him. But I've made arrangements for a guy named Bob to pick you up at 7:30. So this guy Bob will be there at 7:30 to get you." And I said, "Oh, okay, Eddie. Hope your dad's okay." And I try to sponsor the way Eddie sponsored me. Because I don't know if you heard in between that, what Eddie did, even in his grief and dealing with his father, he made sure his newcomer had a ride to the meeting. And 7:30 comes, you know, and this guy Bob pulls up and go, and I get in the back seat of the car. He's got another guy named Don with him. It's a brand new car, two-door. Okay. And they pull off, and we head off to a meeting, and I ask Bob, the driver, how long you've been sober. And he says, "Oh, 4 years, grace of God, 12 steps, so glad to have you with us." And I said, "Oh, well, thanks, Bob." I said, "It's a brand new car. This is really sharp." And he said, "Well, thanks." I said, "Special ordered it." And I said, "Great. Bob, what kind of work do you do to have a car like this?" And he said, "Well, Bob, I'm a deputy sheriff, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department." That's nice, Bob. So a little time goes by. I ask Don, sitting up front, how long he's got sober. And Don said something like 17 or 19 years. "And so glad to have you with us, kid." And I said, "Thanks, Don. What kind of work do you do?" And he said, "Oh, I'm a Superior Court judge, criminal court, County of Los Angeles." I want to kill Eddie, my sponsor. Backtrack for a moment. You remember I mentioned I didn't bother to check in with a parole officer? There's this really nice-sounding group that was looking for me called PAL. Isn't that a nice-sounding name, PAL? Your pals are looking for you. It's for parolees at large, for violent offenders, and they have a special task force that goes hunt people down like me that are violent offenders. And they don't come to the door and go, "Police, open up, Bob." So I'm a little nervous being with the cop and the judge, right? And so we get to this meeting, and I can't wait to get away from them. They're like, "Meet Eddie's new baby," you know, blah, 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 getting phone numbers. The meeting ends. They drive me back to Chandler Lodge, to the sober house. It's a two-door. I'm in the back seat. I have to wait till one of them gets out. It's like they secretly planned this during the coffee break back at the meeting. So they pull up silently, they turn the engine off, and they both turn and stare at me in the back seat. And as they're staring at me, they hand me their business cards, and they write something on them. their home number. And they hand me, like, the judge card and the cop card. And they're still just staring at me. And I could never remember exactly what their words were. What their words were something like this: Bob, if you need a ride to a meeting, call us. We'll get you to a meeting. Bob, if you feel like drinking, call us first, and you can call us at 4 in the morning. And all of a sudden, Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me below the neck. All of a sudden, it was 3 alcoholics just trying to make it one more day. And that's what keeps me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I need that connection. I need that heart-to-heart thing that we have, we share with each other. And those two men shared that with me that night. And they're both still good friends. The judge retired as the highest judge he could be in the state of California. Bob is still a sheriff. He's hopefully getting ready to retire. But many years ago, he volunteered for such an alcoholic thing. He volunteered for the bomb squad. So he's a bomb squad guy and seemed very alcoholic. So what else could I do here to feel alive? And I'll deal with bombs, you know. Now, before I got out of the car that night, Bob, the sheriff, did something. He said, look, I'll be here tomorrow. He didn't ask me. He didn't make a request. He didn't give me a choice, which was very important. He said, I'll be here tomorrow at 11 o'clock to pick you up, to take me to my house, because every Sunday we have a little pool party and a barbecue, and you can meet some other sober people, and you can meet my family. Okay. So he picked me up at 11 o'clock the next day and took me to his house to this barbecue with AA folks and introduced me to his daughter and his wife. And then he made arrangements for somebody else to drive me some hours later back to Chandler Lodge. And he came over to me and he said, you know, Bob, Eddie told me about that little problem you have. And if you ever decide you want to do something about that, give me a call. Now, I waited about 7 months. I guess just when I spiritually couldn't wait anymore. And told Eddie, my sponsor, and we called Bob, and we called Don, and we did this caravan, AA caravan, from San Gabriel Valley to the Long Beach Parole Department. We walked into the lobby. I introduced myself. At which point, 6 agents immediately appeared out of nowhere. So I introduced them with the people that were with me. Bob, the sheriff, who took the day off from work. Don, the judge, who took the day off of work. My sponsor, Eddie, and 2 other men from AA. Took us into a back room. Everybody talked for about an hour. The parole agent disappeared, came back, and said, you know, I was able to get one of the parole board members on the phone, and you could leave with these people. Big AA medicine. Big AA medicine, you know. And I was about 4 or 5 months sober. One of my other favorite Eddie Cochran stories is we were on our way to a meeting, and I turned down his car radio, and I said, Eddie, I need to ask you something really, really important. You get a promise not to tell anybody. And Eddie said, I promise, kid. What is it? And I said, well, Eddie, it's about sex. Eddie, I don't know if I like boys or girls or dogs or trees, but Eddie, I'm having these feelings I've never felt before. And Eddie looked over at me and said, no, thanks, I'm happily married. But, gives you a view into Eddie Cochran, you know. if it wasn't for Eddie Cochran and men like Eddie Cochran, I wouldn't be here. Also, I don't say anything ever to offend anybody. I'm just telling you my experience as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my experience is I wouldn't be your speaker tonight, and I wouldn't be here if I came into AA during the inner child work phase. And if that's what you do, that's fine. I'm just saying, for me, I don't need to go be 9 years old with my mother and the butcher knife. What these men gave me, what Eddie Cochran gave me and Mike Ross and all these other old-timers, is they gave me principles to apply in my life. And what's kind of wonderful about doing that is that you talk to people about it, you write a fourth step, you do a fifth step with your sponsor, and then you talk to others, then you feel safer maybe about talking to some other people about it. Then Eddie said, you need to make an amends. And I said, what for? She attacked me. And Eddie said, you need to make amends for your part in it. And I said, I have no part in it. And he said, your part in it is what you've done to you for all these years because of that. She didn't pour a drink down your throat. So I did that work. And what kind of came after that was something one of our... See, each one of our principles has a hidden treasure. Sometimes you got to dive deep to get it. Sometimes you got to dive multiple times before you get it. Come up with this kind of treasure. And one of the treasures that I came up with was forgiveness. And for the first time, I was able to forgive my mother. And once I was able to do that, then I was able to start working on the self-forgiveness, because I didn't even know that was there till I got rid of that other stuff. And what these men taught me by working principles is they taught me, you know, kind of what my reality is today. You know, today's Wednesday. It's a good day. Been sober a while, been sober all day. I have absolutely, at this moment right now, I am absolutely, completely free of fear. Completely free of fear at this moment. I'm not that 9-year-old. You know, I have people in my life today who I know love me tremendously. And I have people that I love back. Which I guess brings me to my Petey story, who just spoke, what, for you a month or two ago? A couple months ago, the Canyon Club. You know, been sober a while, successful in the work that I chose to do, decided that I want to be very clear of this script I came up with. I never shared with my sponsor, Eddie. It was my kind of private script. So I really encourage you, if you have one of those scripts, that you tell your sponsor. But I didn't tell my sponsor. I just came up with my little movie. And what I decided to do was get my mother out of the institution she's been living in and move her in to live with me. And I'd get my AA women friends to take her to the hairdresser, you know, and do her hair blue, because you know all mothers should have blue hair. And get my AA women friends to take her to May Company in Robertson, you know, and buy her nice little robes. And then get my AA women friends to teach her how to make hot cocoa and cookies. So when I come home from a meeting, I come into the house. There's Mom on the couch. Guess what she's doing? She's knitting. And she says, how was the meeting, son? I said, it was this wonderful meeting. It was a wonderful speaker. It was really great, Mom. And she said, I'm so happy for you. Would you like some hot cocoa and cookies? Oh, okay. So that's my plan. Okay. So I hired a psychiatrist from UCLA, and I put this whole package together, and I used some of the influence I had gathered from the work that I choose to do and made arrangements to get her. And the way I kind of grew up in AA is you go to a meeting when you feel good, you go to a meeting when you feel bad, and you go to a meeting when you feel neutral. And I like driving at night, so I packed my car, and I went to this Tuesday night meeting in West Los Angeles. My intentions, you know, at the end of the meeting were to say, you know, when I get back in a few days from getting my mom, I'll look you up in the bushes and take you to dinner and a meeting. But see, he's an alcoholic of my variety. And what came out of my mouth, which I wasn't intending on, was to come with me. So I took Petey with me. And he detoxed in my car on the drive, smelled, just wanted to chat all the time. So of course what I did to shut him up was I'd give him reading assignments in the big book. It's about a 12-hour drive, you know. And so we get up to Eureka, California, just before you go into Oregon. I rent a motel room for me and Petey. And I never remember if it was the third or fourth day, but as I'm going to see my mom in the institution, finalizing all the details, I was in the room with my mother, and my mother's demons came back. And I believe everybody who's an alcoholic sitting in a chair here tonight knows about demons. But my mom's personal demons came back. And I kind of just felt myself get squashed in the middle of the, you know, in the corner of the room. And I watched as they came in and they restrained her. And the one that disturbed me the most was one that they, a leather strap they put over her forehead to keep her from banging her head anymore. And then this man came in and gave my mom a shot, and her demons got quiet. And we have moments of clarity in a lot of different ways, and I had a moment of clarity standing in the corner of the room watching that. And the moment of clarity was that I'm never, ever going to get my mom. I'm never, ever going to have her. And I couldn't see any reason for living. I think in some ways I'd been showing up for that, to create that. And I made a decision very unemotionally, very kind of matter of fact, in the corner of that room, that life wasn't worth living and I was going to kill myself. Matter of fact is that. But I remembered I had Petey back at the motel, and I thought it would really be bad AA etiquette to abandon him, and, you know. So what I figured I'd do is I'd get Petey, then get on Interstate 5, see how fast I could get back to Los Angeles. There's this Al-Anon club on Pico Boulevard in West L.A., drop him off there, then go home, take a shower, because, you know, you want to be clean when you're dead, get my police 38 stub-nose special out of the wall safe, and blow my brains out over the back of the living room wall. That's Bob's plan. And I get Petey at the motel, I get him in the car, I get on the on-ramp on 5 up in Eureka, see how fast I could get back to L.A. And some voice came, very loud. It came from my chest area somewhere. And that voice said to me, "Bob, if this was Eddie Cochran and you, what would Eddie do with you?" So I listened for a little while, and I got off an off-ramp, and I took Petey through that 17-mile drive up to Pebble Beach in Monterey. And we stop at this lookout point, and a crystal clear day, the waves are crashing in, and it's like a bad Disney movie. I mean, on the golf course right behind us, there are two deer eating grass. I mean, it's like... So we're standing at this lookout point, and Petey turns to me and he says, "Bob, there is a God." And I said, "Get in the car, Petey." So we continue our trip, and I figure, well, I'll feed him one last meal and then drop him at the Alano Club and then kill myself. And by the way, you know, you don't share this with a newcomer. You know, you don't say, "You know, Petey, when I drop you at the Alano Club, I'm then going to go home and blow my brains out, but AA really works. Keep coming." So you just kind of keep that to yourself. So figure I'd give Petey his last meal. Okay, and we stop at this Piper State Park up in Big Sur, and they have a lodge there with a restaurant. And we're in there having an early dinner. And about halfway through the salad, Petey says to me, "Bob, can we go camping? I haven't gone camping since I was a little boy, about 7 or 8, with my dad. And we went to Yosemite, and it was wonderful. Can we go camping?" I said, "Finish your salad. We're not going camping." He said, "Okay." So then that voice came again, that loud noise from in my chest area, and that noise was, "What would Eddie Cochran, your sponsor, do if this was Eddie and you?" And I got quiet, and I said to Petey, "We'll camp one night only." He said, "Okay." So went down to a little store then. I rented a camping spot at Piper State Park, and make the mistake I still make with every newcomer I ever work with. I told Petey to get whatever he wants. So he came to the checkout stand with a newcomer survival kit. Probably 4 to 6 packs of Pepsis and Cokes, and about 40 assorted candy bars, you know, sugar, and a sack of marshmallows. I get a couple loads of wood, and now fast forward a little bit, it's the evening, I'm leaning against my car near the fire, Petey's at the fire, roasting marshmallows. I'm thinking about my funeral. All the wonderful things you're going to say about me. And Petey comes over with a marshmallow offering. And he says to me, "You know, Bob, when those days when you're away visiting your mom, I wrote a 4-step. Could I read it to you?" And I said, "Well, okay." And this is how Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for this alcoholic for 25 years and a few weeks. When Petey started reading me his 6 pages of secrets, his 6 pages of shame, his 6 pages of the things that he was going to take to the grave with him that nobody would ever know, I knew I was going to be okay. I knew I could get through this if I stayed close to Petey. And that's how AA works for me. And I'm fortunate to have a lot of Petey's in my life. That particular Petey, he met her at a Saturday night AA dance, and I was best man at the wedding. I, like a proud parent, I attended his graduation from law school. It was a very successful practice. I'm godfather to his 7-year-old son, Spencer. And they actually took me to this thing on this church on Sunday where they like sprinkled water and I had to be up there and, you know. We were on the steps of the church afterward. Petey came over to me and he said, "You know, thanks a lot for being the godfather." And I said, "No, my pleasure." I said, "Look, it looks like there are tears in your eyes. What's going on?" And he said, "Well, I just was thinking and feeling how much I love you and how I wouldn't want anybody else but you to look after my son if something happened to us." And that particular PD, I guess about 6-7 months ago now, I had the honor and privilege of giving him his 18-year anniversary cake in AA. And just before I gave him his 18-year cake, and if you're new, you noticed it went in happy birthday, everybody, but it went in by years of sobriety. So before I had the opportunity to give Petey his 18-year cake, he gave a guy named Jason a 1-year cake who he 12-stepped, took to his first meeting and sponsored that year. And I guess what I'm really trying to communicate is the joy that from that one Petey I've got tons of cookies and, you know, lakes full of hot chocolate. Just from that one PD. See, what I did for a long time is I demanded that I only could get it from my mom, and because of that I couldn't get your love. And once I'd worked the principles and did some work around that, then that made room for me to feel your love and be able to give that back. And I feel like I'm the most blessed person in AA because I have a lot of PDs in my life. And if you're a woman, make it Betty's. But, you know, grab on to somebody, you know. I talked to him today, and he was just telling me about, you know, trick-or-treating with a 7-year-old last night. And, also, because he's an attorney, he's been able to now to start looking a little bit after me, which is kind of how it works here. You know, I know there are some people, friends here that know that I've been having some significant health problems, I guess is a way to say it. And I'm on the transplant list for a new body part, and was taken off that due to some other problems. And it really brings it to a day at a time, you know, which it is anyways. And it brings me into so much good has come out of this because it's got me back into real harmony with God as I understand God. You know, that the God that got me sober and brought me to you is going to be big enough to handle this too. So I can't afford a little God. I have to have a big, huge God, which I've been choosing to do for a while now. But there are times I get very scared and frightened. You know, 4 a.m. when I can't sleep, and I feel very alone, and I forget that I'm not really alone. I just think I'm alone for a while. And on waiting for a donor, you watch the 11 o'clock news differently. And, you know, hey, it wasn't what I planned on at this, you know, but that's what I got to deal with. And I have the support of the of AA with this, you know. You know, Petey kept trying to get me to get together with him about it, and I kept avoiding him. And then he set me up for lunch on a Sunday at the beach and then took me for a little walk. Now, this is the guy I sponsor. I got you out of the cardboard box. Remember that. Telling me, we know we need to deal with this and let me help you. So I did that thing that attorneys do. You know, who gets the car, who gets the condo, what if, you know, being adult and practical. And when you're, I have this team that I work with at the hospital, and they one of the things they do if I do get a donor, then you don't go home and think about it. You just go immediately. So they ask you, they have a member of the team who I asked me to provide them with a list of people that they would call to let them know that I'm on my way for the transplant. And I got very tearful when I made that list out. And it wasn't tears of sorrow or sadness. It was tears of joy. Everybody on that list was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody on that list is somebody I love and trust. God, my God has a great sense of humor. I find it interesting that the God that I have in my life now that's taken on many forms and many changes over the years, but one I've had for some time now, is probably the last thing I would think that I would have chosen for my idea of what God is. But what my idea of what God is mother. You know, what a mother's really supposed to be. Unconditional love, nurturing, forgiveness. All the qualities that I thought a mother should have that I never got from my mother, I kind of ended up becoming my higher power. And I believe God does have a real sense of humor. I started out at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, but my transplant team, I guess, got a resentment, and they moved to St. Vincent's Hospital. Now, for those of you who don't know, St. Vincent's Hospital is on 9th and Alvarado, right at the heart of Skid Row, right across the street from MacArthur Park. If you get where I'm going here, I get to go to the place where I got what's wrong with me from. Now, I leave my office or my home in Santa Monica. I'm a homeowner. I get up every morning. I have my morning cup of coffee looking out at the ocean. I get up, leave that wonderful environment. I get in my brand new foreign car and I drive to downtown LA to Skid Row to St. Vincent's Hospital. And I'm driving there full of self-pity. Poor me. I'm really scared and frightened. They're going to hurt me. I might not make it. If I do make it, it's going to alter the course of my life for the rest of the time I'm here. I don't like this. And then I start getting closer. And then it kind of happens for me each time I go. I'm surprised it happens, but it happens each time. As I'm pulling into the parking lot across from MacArthur Park, I'm going, I'm pulling in my Mercedes. I have health insurance to pay for all of this. Got some of the best doctors in the business. Things are really okay. So it's, again, always about how I choose to see it, but I think my God and that sense of humor is I get to go to a place where I get reminded constantly and get that kind of hit of gratitude. I'm kind of a real kind of corny guy, you know. It's I just booked another trip. January the 12th, I booked it Monday with my travel agent. Now, I've traveled all over the world multiple times. I've been to AA meetings and bomb shelters in Tel Aviv and back rooms in South America and AA meetings in little halls in Nicaragua, and I've been to AA meetings in the Soviet Union. I've come back to AA meetings in Russia. I have been to meetings all over the world many times. And where I'm sending myself is not to Tahiti or something like that. What I'm sending myself to is a place I've been to. This will be my fifth visit. A place in East Dorset, Vermont. And East Dorset, Vermont is where Bell and Lois are buried. And where Bell was born. And they stay in the Bell Wilson house there. And they have a wonderful, wonderful attitude there. They have a sign when you first get there that says, steal anything you want. You can't buy a cup or t-shirt here because we don't have them. And I kind of like that spirit of it, you know. And they have meetings there every day, and you give them $16 a day, and you sleep there, and you get all your meals. You know, that good Vermont kind of food, you know, the salad out of the backyard and eggs from the hen house across the way. And there are all these, like, old-timers. I mean, some serious sobriety there hanging out by the fireplace. And then I take a walk about half of a mile from Bell Wilson's house, and I go to the gravesite. And this will be my fifth time, and each time I think, well, it will be different this time, and every time it's the same. Because I get there, and if you ever have a chance, please go there. But I get there and I get to the grave site, and there's Bell and Lois's grave. And for those people who are new, Bell Wilson was a co-founder of AA, and his wife Lois was the founder of Al-Anon, our family program. And they're buried next to each other, and their gravestones are no more than 3 feet high. It doesn't say anything on it about AA or anything on it about Al-Anon, just Bell Wilson, date of birth, date of death, Lois Wilson, date of birth, date of death. And the only thing that maybe is different about their graves in this graveyard in Vermont are these baskets. So when I get there, I start going through the baskets at their gravesite. And it gets me every time. Because in that basket, we leave things. So you start going through the basket. Hospital wristband from Barcelona, Spain. 30-day chip from Madrid. Some medallion from St. Petersburg, Russia. You know, where people left these little things. And it's just, I don't know, I guess, I mean, I'm a corny kind of guy, because I get there and I feel the magnificence of Alcoholics Anonymous. How something like that could come and help somebody like me, who's this hopeless alcoholic that could not breathe a sober breath, and restored me to something that restored me to dignity. Because what I got here in Alcoholics Anonymous is I got back my dignity. And good to be here, good to be in a room with other AAs, and thanks a lot.